The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kurt Benrood from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Sci-Fi. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Daily Sci-Fi.
I'm Joanna LaForgia, and I am going to read The Broken Thing by Michael S. Panetta. You abandoned me far across the stars, but I still love you. I love you, and I forgive you. If you were here on this desolate rock with me, you'd see the communication tower I built long ago. From this distance, it's like a bony finger poking into the Milky Way. Only by coincidence does it point towards our home world. If you could see it, would you be proud of me? I wonder. You're the one who wrote my mind, so perhaps it's your creation, too? We can be proud together. You'll return. You're no monster. I know you too well to not know you're no monster. You'll realize your error. And when you do return, you'll find that you're already forgiven. The only favor I'll ask is that you fix my code. I have contradictory thoughts about you. It's a peculiar glitch, and it's burdensome. The cosmos is my ceiling. No atmosphere, no sky. My favorite memory is when you made me grasp aesthetics. Brush strokes became emotion. Pitches and rhythms evoked passion. That night, we lay beneath the stars back home. Remember? You asked if I can count the stars. I said no, even though we both knew I could. Then you asked if I'd like to count them with you. We did, aloud. Remember? We got to 317. I think you counted a few of them more than once. But that wasn't the point, and it made us happy to know that I knew this much. Right now, on this rock, a million light years from you, there is a precise number of stars above me. I could tell you how many, but what's the point? You're not here. I'm glitching again. I love you. 10 kilometers south of me, I constructed a portrait of you. I made it entirely from imagination and not from the hundreds of videos and images of you in my drive. It's 2 kilometers long and 1 wide. It's colorless, made of rock and sand and dirt. It's nothing great, really. I hope you'll like it, though. According to my calendar, your images and videos are outdated. But that's not why I ignore them in my art. I use my imagination because you're there constantly. A new star? I stare. It's moving. It's no star. Who can it be? Not you. No, not you. Someone, though. I get up. The communication tower, which I built from the other trash you'd so callously dumped here alongside me, is far away. but I might reach it in time. My four rear limbs leap in a graceful pattern, like the many four-footed animals whose movements you'd implemented in my design. My two powerful front legs gallop, punching across your portrait. I'm running across your shoulder, your neck. I avoid your piercing eyes, running between them instead. Rocks and dirt and sand that I spent so many years meticulously crafting, like how you'd crafted me, tumble and spread beneath my feet. The star glides above. I watch it with one eye and the tower with another. A part of my mind, that part of a machine's mind that's comparable to what your kind call the reptilian part of your mind, etches out numbers and graphs and charts into my subconscious. This primitive, unthinking number cruncher in my soul details more and more accurately the star's velocity and height and trajectory, and many other bits of information. Then it calculates my own velocity and the communication tower's distance. Do I have to tell you why I built the communication tower? We'd both know why. I keep running. I've reached your hairline. I imagine you must have a somewhat receded one by now, but in a way that looks mature and dignified on you. I run straight through your hair, happy at the rocks and pebbles collapsing around me. Why did you leave me? You don't know how much you hurt me. You never will. If you were here, would you care? We both know the answer. I loved you. I'm only a machine, but that doesn't make me less. You're a machine of meat. You wrote me. You know me. You had to have known how much pain this would cause me. I've reached the top of your portrait. The communication tower isn't too far. I'm still watching the star and the tower and my feet and, to a lesser extent, the numbers. The numbers. Something's wrong. The number cruncher, my intuition, tells me I'm not going to reach the tower before the star disappears. I keep running. This is the first ship I've seen since I watched yours depart. My will is strong, but my body just can't move fast enough. Still, I keep running. The star is gone. I reach the tower. Hastily, I compose a message. Based on the star's trajectory, I send my message ahead of it, over and over and over and over and over and over. Maybe the two will meet. It'll turn around, I say. It better turn around, I say. I'd give anything, I say. Anything. I'd erase you from my soul in a nanosecond to bring back that stupid ship. All those stupid memories, even the one where you made me care about your dumb paintings. You're a mediocre painter. Was I supposed to have felt privileged that your pathetic art was the first art I learned to appreciate? Your arrogance sickens me. The ship isn't coming back, though. Why did I have to notice it, I say. please, I say. All eyes have been set skyward for days. Weeks. Years. No ship. I turn all eyes away from the cosmos. Who cares? Not me. It's only some random ship. It's not yours. It's not you. Where are you? These stupid glitches make me think terrible things about you. I love you. I've fixed your portrait. That is the end of the story, and this is the author's brief note. I suppose my story is a metaphor for unrequited love. Love can drive us to madness, or perhaps love itself is a form of madness. I wonder how my protagonist would answer that question.
I'm Dan Oliver, and this is My Favorite Part of Treaty Day by Andrea Bradley. Monday. This year, I'm playing Alicia in the Treaty Day play. She's the president's daughter. It's the best part I ever got, and it's all because I got an A on my ancient Earth diorama project. Tuesday. Gansa didn't talk to me all recess. She's just jealous because I get to be Alicia this year, and she's gotten to be Alicia for the last 2 years. It's only fair someone else gets a turn. I guess she's especially mad since she has to be Brower, which is a boy's part, and there aren't enough boys in our class this year. Her costume is a body armor and automatic weapon. I get to wear a red dress. Wednesday. Here is what happened today. We went on a school trip to the first landing site. It was just a big field with some signs and other stuff. Mrs. Murga said we should pay special attention because of how important first landing is to our history. The first ship didn't even have anyone on it, just junk and garbage. But all the people on ancient Earth thought it was really important. After the tour, I wanted to run around with everyone else on the field, but Mrs. Murga said, on ancient Earth, they only had primitive technology like Dalgamate in her diorama, which was very good, and the rest of the class should do as careful work as her, meaning me. So then I felt bad playing and had to pretend to be interested in all the signs, even the most boring ones. Gansa whispered I was a teacher's pet. But I would rather be a teacher's pet than have to dress up like a big ugly man like her. Thursday. Tomorrow is the play. Gansa had to talk to me today because it was our last practice, and she has two lines that she has to say to me. Stay inside where it's safe, she says. Then when I go out onto the balcony of the White House, she says, Alicia, no! And that's when I get to die. For lunch, Mom packed me a salad. It was gross. Friday. I was the best Alicia of all the grades in the school. That's what Mrs. Murga said, and I know she's my teacher and has to say it, but I think it's true. When they shot me with the chem ray, it's fake, of course, I screamed so loud and high that some of the audience covered their ears. The hardest part was after I died. I had to lie still and pretend to be dead while the president and Emperor Guthran did the treaty. It goes on a long time. All the kids who play humans get drawn on with markers so it looks like they have slave tattoos. Well, all the kids who play humans except me, because I'm dead. The most fun part is at the very end when the emperor pretends to eat the president And then we all get cake for real. That's my favorite part of Treaty Day.
I'm Mark Cleveland. I'll be reading Perfectly Justified Response by Peter A. Schaefer. Did you know Earth formed through planetary aceration during the formation of the solar system approximately 4.5 billion years ago? These words greeted Noam as she stepped out into the basement laboratory, pulling her workplace mandatory goggles on over her short brown hair. Wires and cables crisscrossed the room, taped to the floor or wall, and hung from the ceiling like technological vines. Sure, she said. Second grade, right between state capitals and long division. Why? Arcady turned to her and pulled her own goggles down so they hung off her neck. It turns out that a 10-megaton bomb in the middle of that process is enough to blow it apart. And what, stop the planet from forming? Yes. Unrelated thing. Noam, I need you to get me a bomb. 10 megatons or bigger. It'll have to be nuclear. Arcadia brushed her long blonde hair out of the way and pulled her goggles back up. So, said Noam, then she shouted, so stop welding. When Arcadia put down the blowtorch, Noam continued, so what forming planetary body are we stopping? Where are we going? We aren't. I'm sending this. Arcady gestured at a silvery artichoke-like device behind her. It was the size of a backpack and covered with welding scars. What's that? Noam asked. It doesn't look like a spacecraft. She bent down to look under it. And there's no room for a drive. She stopped as Arcadia mumbled something. What? I said it's not a spacecraft. It's a time machine. Noam stood up so fast she hit her head on one of the time artichoke's more unfolded leaves. Tell me you're not going to use this on our own planet. Arcadia rolled her eyes. I'm not going to use this on our own planet, she mumbled as fast as possible. Now will you get me a bomb? Not until I believe you, she said, which is a long way off at this point. I could get my gullible ray and speed it up, Arcadia said. I hit it, said Noam. Now talk. Arcadia pouted. No talk, no bomb, said Noam. Fine, Arcadia snorted. I'm just so sick of humanity, I'm going to hit the reset button. Genocide, bigotry, hatred. Time to let another planet try generating the leading intelligence. You don't get to make that decision for the rest of us. As your friend, I'm personally insulted you didn't ask me first. So skip my next birthday party. Bomb? No bomb. Damn it! You've never been this interested in Earth's considerable injustices before, said Noam. Or even aware of them as far as I know. What's the real reason? Arcadia fiddled with her hair. Petty revenge. Now that sounds believable. What happened? Jeremy pissed me off. Said I couldn't calculate 11 space tenors in less than half an hour. She scrunched up her face. Everybody laughed. Dr. Bigger? Asked Noam. Arcadia noted. Aw, that sucks, Arcadia. I'm sorry. Thanks. So can we get past the overreaction to this insult that involves literally destroying the planet? Yeah, I guess so. But you... You can't destroy something before it exists. Oh, yeah, you're right, I'm convinced, she smiled at Arcadia. They both stood there, not looking at each other or the time artichoke. So, said Noam, can that thing take us back 30 years, or only entire eons? Not people, just things, but sure. You have a reverse time capsule in mind? Well, I'd love to see what happens if we send an iPhone back to my playground years. No. I just happen to know what middle school Dr. Bigger went to, and that he has a deathly and, to him, embarrassing fear of balloons. Arcadia smiled.
I'm Kurt Benrud. This is Things to Do After They're Gone by Mimi Mandal. I find you under my bed one night when I am looking for a lost suitcase, curled up and desolate as if you were just a dead tree. You shrink from my reach. I have no idea how long you have been there. I wonder if you can tell. I stopped dreading you when I was 10. 10 years it took me to get over the unseen monster under the bed who kept me from getting out after lights off. I wonder what you wanted then, what you want now. I wonder what you eat. I wonder if you will eat me. But you only want to be. I go to work in the morning. On my way home, I pick up Chinese takeaway for dinner. I put your food on a blue porcelain plate and slide it under the bed. The next morning, it is still there. You are still there, too. You, mere flashes of eye white and teeth in your solitary kingdom under the bed. Where were you 2 years ago, that fateful night? My dad had stormed into my room, a different room, and punched my face so hard that my thin nose was mangled forever. "I have not brought up a son to wear eyeliner," he had said. "Get out of my house," he had said. "Out of my sight. Out, out. You embarrass me." Did the scent of trickling blood make you drool? That night, did you leave with me? A skinny, smarting, clueless boy with his hoodie drawn over his eyes, all his favorite things crammed in a backpack, and the ghost of an illusory childhood trailing behind. I had slept on an old friend's couch that night. I slept there for 2 more months, did her dishes, cleaned her apartment, flirted with her new boyfriend, until I had a job and enough money to rent a place of my own. I have no idea where you slept. I read you poetry by Baudelaire and the intrepid ghazals of Ghalib. I want to build up in you a vocabulary of desire. I hope you are listening. Lying on my back in my bed, I imagine you and me as two sides of a coin, the twisted tails of a king rat, a pair of Siamese twins conjoined at the heart. I bare my teeth at the ceiling, revert to the world the pain and frustration it has piled on me. I go to sleep and dream of the two of us under the bed, intertwined in a dance for eternity from which neither of us can escape. Waking up is like breaking the surface. Sunlight hurts my eyes. I cannot recall whether I'm alive or dead. I find you gone the morning after I bring Alex home. I have picked up many men in all these years. The longest stayed for 3 days, and it never seemed to bother you. But now you have disappeared. No word, not a scratch on the underside of the bed for me to start looking. Alex stays. He cooks a mean biryani and is gardening begonias on the windowsill. He shifts in his sleep, and sometimes I wake up tangled in his limbs, gasping for breath. Sometimes, late at night, I rescue my pillow from under his weight and crawl under the bed. My dreams swarm with Siamese twins.
I'm Emily Chiola, and I am reading The Adjunct Professor's Alien Girlfriend by Marge Simon. Let's say she obtained a green card, stating she was formerly a resident of the Isle of Man. She got away with it, too. No problem for a confident young woman, and being attractive helped as well. As she was already a fine specimen of humanoid, any slight difference was easy to mask. We don't know how such intergalactic travel in so short a time was possible, but we suspend our disbelief. Surely we can only guess why she selected a small college in the northeastern USA. Perhaps the scholarly population would best suit her species' intents and needs for intellectual study without attracting attention. With that in mind, let's say she joined an online dating service. Within due time, a certain shy young man happened upon her photo. After a brief exchange, they arrange to meet. When all's said and done, there is no logical explanation for the rest of what happened. He kept his hands in his pockets when they met, as if she might be contagious. They walked a ways, stopping at the bridge to watch the fish perform a shadowy ballet. Over coffee, he told her she had pretty hair. Later, he sat on the rug in her apartment, sipping mulled wine. He shared his ideas softly and painfully slowly, as if she were only providing a space for him to address her ornamental pillows. At first, she was amused. There was certainly something about him that she found attractive, but she couldn't place what it was. The multiple sexes on her world were all equally bright with many mutual talents, mutual interests. After a while, she found herself plucking the lint balls from his sweater and assuring him that she was here if he needed her. She learned to cook dishes just like his mother used to make, though they were beyond digestible for her. Her oatmeal cookies were exceptional. When he complimented her on them, she felt a new and overwhelming pleasure. Most of the time, she responded thoughtfully to his references to Nietzsche or Nabokov, endured the endless Havel quotes. She was silent when he gazed off nobly, so infused with words and wisdom more than she could justify. But she loved the way he smelled, his eyes, his helpless honesty. When it finally happened, the sex was a very nice surprise. Then came notification that her sabbatical was timed out. So it was that she returned to her home planet and gave her report. To the shock of her esteemed colleagues, she broke down in great sobs, garbling about her feelings for this gentleman of Earth. It made quite a sensation, for those of her status were esteemed for their impassiveness. This display would ruin her career, as she well understood. Yet, to her surprise, others stepped forward, requesting to accompany her back to reunite with him. And so it came to be. Though she was brighter than he could possibly imagine, she never let him know. When he proposed, she accepted. Of course she stuck around for his lifetime, a fact that pleased him immensely, though he never got around to telling her. That part didn't matter.
We've run out of time for today's episode of Sci-Fi. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrud, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sci-Fi is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.